One of the programs that we regularly do, of course, is our citizen science program and the ADU slot. Well, it's not only citizen science within that ADU slot. It's also talking about some of the research work that's undertaken. Sitting with Justin Orion and finding out more about one of the favorite creatures in, for many people, I suppose, one of the feared ones, and that's the white shark, and also bringing in seals. The reason that I rather like this program is Gordon Hiles, who will be listening and who often talks to us about underwater photography and working with a variety of filming operations. He dived in the early years without shark cages as they were doing the filming of people like Ron and Valerie Taylor, who were working and testing their shark suit. And of course, Gordon and company were in the water filming this. And when I said to him, what about white sharks and a cage? He looked at me a little blankly. Well, white sharks and seals in False Bay. Now, this doesn't sound like a good thing to be together, Justin.
No, it's very good for the sharks, of course, but it's not such a good thing for the seals. And the seals, as a result of this extraordinary form of predation, when I say extraordinary, imagine being able to go to any given place in the Kruger National Park and witness on a sort of daily basis guaranteed predation events between a lion, say, and an impala. It just doesn't happen. Whereas at Seal Island in False Bay, my student used to refer to it as being breakfast, there is a predator-prey interaction which is reliable as clockwork and extraordinary to witness.
With this sort of clockwork status, is this a case of, sorry, George, you're the first seal out in the morning, tough?
Actually, yes, it's more that you're the last one coming back. So what the seals try and do is they're trying to avoid coming back during the danger time, which is sunrise for the first 2 hours after sunrise. I think what happens there is that the seal forms a silhouette on the surface so that a shark hidden in the depths, of course, sharks are counter-shaded. They're called white sharks, but they're dark on the top and they're light-colored on the ventral surface. So for a seal looking down, it can't see the shark. And of course, it at sunrise is perfectly silhouetted against a light background. And these sharks exploit the deep water and they approach at great speed from depth and they hit the seal swimming on the surface. And that's why you get these spectacular reach attacks, which are fairly unique to Seal Island in False Bay.
This is something that's been carrying on since the start of time.
We don't know. Because there are many other islands with white sharks and seals, and yet it's most prevalent here, it might actually just be that there are some sharks that have learnt that this is the best way of getting these seals. Of course, you wouldn't want to breach on an elephant seal because you might break your mouth. So there's got a whole lot of other variables that are certainly coming into this. But what we do know is that it is the best place on the planet for witnessing, you know, a 5-meter predator leaping out of the water on a 1-meter snack.
I'm just trying to get my mind around what this must look like, because what are we talking about here? A shark that is 7 to 9 meters long?
No, five. I mean, a PhD student, Alison Cock, has showed that most of the sharks here in False Bay are immature. So 3.5, 4 meters is getting towards the big side. But you do get the odd 5-meter shark, and you'll have 5 meters of vertebrate launching out of the water with or without a seal in its mouth.
I mean, this is obviously just absolutely raw power.
Absolutely. I mean, phenomenal. And a huge amount of energy required, you know, to do this. So it's a significant investment for the shark, and the rewards need to be suitably high. And we think they are. A young seal pup, which is what they're targeting mostly, and I can tell you why we think that is fat and full of milk. So a good reward.
Yeah, I'm just kind of making sure, knowing my body shape, I'm not going anywhere near there, because the damn thing's going to come out of the water and get on the boat and I'm going to be food. Now, adaptation-wise, is there a way that the seals have kind of said, hang on, we got to counter this at all?
Absolutely. So what seems to happen is that the sharks aggregate at the island during winter. That's not for reasons necessarily of water temperature or any other seasonal effect. It's because at that time of the year, you get naive young seals taking to the water, and they haven't learnt about this danger yet. They go out on their first foraging trips looking for solid food, and they get it wrong when they come back. They come back in the danger zone as a sort of skirt around the island where most of the predation takes place. And obviously the sharks concentrate there because they know that all seals have to come there to get to the island. So they optimize their probability of an encounter with a seal by hanging out at the southwest side of the island where most of the seals are coming back. And then it's that sunrise thing. So old seals, mothers, they don't come back during that sunrise, that breakfast time. They come back at nighttime or during the afternoon or some other time. But the young ones, they are the ones that make this fatal error.
have we got sufficient seals to keep on making this error, or is it a case of, chaps, sorry, we need to change your behavior?
We definitely have enough. 77,000 seals approximately on Seal Island, and there doesn't seem to be any impact on the numbers. In fact, the limiting factor at Seal Island is almost certainly land. So the island's just not big enough for more seals. That said, the predation is extraordinary. And of course, the ones that are being creamed off, though, are the youngsters. And that's a good system in a way, because you've got your breeders who carry on producing offspring. And we, for example, put radio tags on 10 of these juveniles to see if they learnt with time to avoid the danger zone. And yes, they did. So towards the end of the season, once they had had a couple of near scrapes or narrow misses, or watched one of their mates being eaten by a white shark, they had adjusted and were following an adult pattern, avoiding breakfast time. And none of our radio-tagged individuals was eaten. So it's not actually a lot of the total number that actually die through sharks, and probably more die as a result of the southeaster, washing them off when they're very little pups and they pitch up on the beach.
When you say this wonderful snack time restaurant, I think we're going to have to rename the place. I'm sure that one of the restaurant chains would love to sponsor the work there and claim sort of responsibility for it in some ways. Do we have a high number of white sharks in that area?
We don't know the total number. Alison Koch, doing her PhD on this, has got a fairly good handle. I think what's clear is that they concentrate around the island. So whatever sharks are in False Bay or in the area are all aggregating at Seal Island during the winter period. So there's hardly a shark anywhere else in the bay. They're all pretty much swirling around looking for an opportunity. And most of them are sitting at the southern end of the island waiting for seals to ration and take their chance. Now, interestingly, when you leave the island, now that's a different story. There, the tactic is not avoidance. When they leave the island, they typically group up. So the seals form a group. Now, you know that horrible feeling. If you're swimming alone in the ocean, you can almost hear that Jaws music playing in your ears, your subconscious. But when you're in a group, you feel safer. So what the seals do is they have a sort of muster point. There's a shallow area near the island and they aggregate there. And we don't know what the cue is, but at a certain point, a group of them will make a dash for it. And that's what really intrigued us about the research, because when you form a group, you obviously don't want to be the one eaten. So there's a couple of selfish rules that a seal can follow in a group to make sure that it is not the one that's eaten.
All this behavior starts to give a complete different viewpoint on what happens, because you always think it is opportunistic, but it doesn't sound like there's anything opportunistic here. This is a well-executed plan on both parties, and it seems to work. And I could also imagine it's why I go out and ferret and forage around with a penguin or two when you can grab a nice young seal.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that sharks hit penguins, but they often just hit them, but don't gobble them up. And I think, the ratio of effort to return is not good enough. Whereas a seal, a young seal full of fat and blubber, or full of fat and milk, I should say, is a good meal. So yes, these two appear to be influencing each other. On an evolutionary level, the sharks are shaping the seals' behavior. And we think it's fascinating that seals have learned to group up as a way of running the gauntlet and reducing their individual chances of being eaten.
One wonders whether they're going to, over time, evolve and sort of group up coming back again, but I suppose that only time will tell. This is obviously seen here in False Bay. What about other parts of the country? Is there anywhere else where seals group on a small island in the same way, and this is a repeated performance?
Absolutely. So we have another student who's just finished her master's at Transbay, Michelle Vissel, and there it was very interesting because there were some fundamental differences. In other words, this morning breakfast zone wasn't nearly as clear. The other thing is that the seals weren't forming these big groups. And what we find is when you go to Transbay is that where the island there is called Giza Rock. And around the island are dense kelp beds. And these kelp beds provide a refuge for the seals. So they can go very close to the sort of edge where the sharks are patrolling, and they can watch them, and they can make a very much more informed decision about their predation risk. And there you get them going in ones and twos and smaller groups. Seal Island, no kelp, no refuge, exposed. When you run, you better run in a group. Otherwise, you're in trouble. So there are other islands, and there are important differences. And this is helping us understand why Seal Island so unique. It is the perfect place for an ambush predator.
Talking of this ambush predator, though, how often does this fellow go along and gobble a seal?
We don't know, actually, for individual sharks, we don't know how often that is. But of a morning, you know, there can be tens, 20, 30, 40, 50 attacks in one morning. I mean, imagine going to a waterhole in Kruger Park and witnessing 40 predation events. Unheard of.
Well, I suppose that one difference, of course, is that lions spend 20 hours of the day eating, sleeping, and procreating. It sounds like your sharks are a hell of a lot busier than that.
Yeah, and of course, until biologists manage to get a better handle on individual identity for things as difficult to get hold of as white sharks, we won't really know that answer. But I think so many sharks aggregating at one area and such a high concentration of food does make for this spectacular feeding fest.
It raises a question: if you're a shark, why swim all the way into the shallows and go and take out a swimmer when you can happily just wait your turn on the south side of the island, guys? Something's going to happen.
And yes, and what happens, of course, is that the seals get more and more astute. So they learn that, hold on a second, this is not a good idea to be in the water at this time of day at this part of the island. So then, before they know it, they've all grown up, and now the sharks are stuck with clever seals. And at that time, which is sort of spring and into summer, then you get large bony fish, yellowtail, that start running on the inshore region. So the sharks and the females only switch to inshore feeding. So they leave the island, the males seem to leave the bay, and the females go inshore. And of course, that's where the problems start. They're looking for fish that are running down from Cape Point all the way across to Musenberg. And the inshore waters are warm, oxygen-rich, and full of food in the form of other fish. And that, of course, is when recreational use of the inshore area peaks with humans. And so sharks and humans come into contact by accident. But of course, every now and again, there's a fatality.
I'm absolutely fascinated that this is a female-only thing and the males head off. Have we any idea where these males go?
No, look, there are satellite tags on these males, and they're going to other areas like Hans Bay. They're going all the way up to as far as Mozambique, and some of them are meeting a sticky end in the likes of Mozambique. But this is very early days, and we just published this paper, and the idea is that there's sexual segregation. In other words, girls go inshore and males are going offshore, and this is the first time it's been documented in an inshore area for a white shark. So it's very exciting. We're just beginning to understand. Most importantly is that this puts females at a higher risk, because they are the ones that are more affected by lethal control. So if people argue for taking out sharks that come too close to inshore, you're going to be hitting your females. You're going to be hitting your breeding females in due course.
Even as a conservationist, it kind of goes against the grain, and even somebody who's prepared to allow humans a certain amount of latitude, it just gores me that we're now going to say that female's hanging around the back line, time to take her out. And I'm just wondering, well, you're hanging around the back line on your surfboard, time to take you out as well?
If you're going to go and hang out in their feeding bowl, then, and you get eaten, then fair enough. That's the risk you took. And of course, what the Shark Spotter program tries to do in Cape Town is not have lethal control. So we're very fortunate that, unlike Natal, which has gone for lethal management options, we have mountains next to sea, which gives people a vantage point. So they can look down at the ocean and they can give people information. I'm not sure whether your listeners know about the Shark Spotter program. I think it's a world first, and it really provides recreational water users with information that they can use to gauge their risk. So if there's a red flag up and you go in the water, you know you're taking a risk. If you then get munched, how can anyone motivate for the removal of the shark when you took a calculated risk?
Yeah, it's rather like getting out of your car in the Kruger Park and going to walk to a pride of lions that are eating an impala and getting really close and then wondering why there's just a camera left. It's one of those sort of Darwin principle things that I've never quite understood. And I think it goes back to, again, many years ago on Bird Island off Port Elizabeth, when they were working the wreck of the Donington, and Albert was the resident white who got a little bit testy after an hour or two of people in the water. And one guy was basically put in the water to Albert watch. And once Albert started getting itchy, well, then everybody got out. Doesn't, obviously, white sharks and the research work is a lot more exciting than people think, because, first of all, we just hear this as this fearsome predator, but there is actually a lot more to it.
Yes, some subtle differences. And I mean, here's the amazing thing. 2013, and we still don't know where these animals give birth. How about that? A large, charismatic predator, and we have no idea where these animals are giving birth. So we're still stuck with missing huge parts of their life history, which are essential for their conservation. And so you really want the world to back off and stop impacting adversely on species like this until we can buy the time to understand them better and make sure that conservation plans at a global level are meaningful for their conservation.
Yeah, I think conservation does get to a point every now and again where you have that NIMBY principle, not in my backyard. And we see it in places in Gauteng where people move in and say, what a cute dussie. And then 3 weeks later, they're trying to work out how to take the dussie out because it's eaten the garden. As soon as something becomes inconvenient with man, we don't want it.
Absolutely. And we immediately explore the cheapest option, which is lethal control. And mitigating with non-lethal measures is very difficult. So what's been proposed, for example, in Fishhook, where there's been the most lethal attacks in recent times, is a exclusion barrier. It's actually a fine-scaled net that simply keeps sharks away from people. If the two can't mix, then there can't be a lethal interaction, and then there will not be calls for the quick and dirty get rid of the thing which is posing a risk. Unfortunately, you can't use this kind of net at large scale. So in the interim, white sharks will continue to every now and again make a mistake, a trial, a nibble. And of course, when a white shark nibbles, legs fall off. And so nibbles get misinterpreted by the press as savage attack, when it really is just a nibble.
Yeah, and again, I think one would go to that point and turn it around and saying, look at the size of that thing's teeth and just be very grateful that megalodons don't still swim in the ocean, because it wouldn't be a nibble, it would just be a munch and a swallow, and that would solve the human problem. And of course, we just want to get rid of everything that is inconvenient to us. Maybe that's the way of putting it. Justin, the work that you guys are doing, the research work, is there anywhere that people can read about it, follow it?
Yes, I think the Shark Spotter website's a very good one. People want to read up on that. There's a lot of information posted on that. And of course, the work is coming out in Alison Cox PhD thesis, and there'll be a lot of papers coming out on that too. So in the primary scientific literature, quite a few popular articles too. The media, they're very interested in the white shark story. So it does get a lot of media coverage. And I think, watch the space. I think the sort of findings that these students are producing are fascinating at a level that we never really thought we would understand big ocean-going predators like white sharks.
Well, and of course, what Justin, as he calls them, as we all now call them, white sharks, yes, that is the great white shark, but it is now simply called the white shark. And of course, if you understand that, go and Google the fellow, find out more about him. I mean, Justin just made a comment now which completely gobsmacked me, and that was that we don't know anything about the birth or where these sharks give birth. And I found that incredible. Very happy we know various different ways of removing them from the ocean, but of course the important thing about how they start, well, simply not known at all. Justin, it's great having you chatting to us about these things. It started out me thinking, what are we going to talk about? And suddenly time disappeared.
Great. Yeah, I think that's the story with the white sharks, and understanding how they impact on other animals like seals and other fish is really important. And then the ultimate goal will be to share this space, to share False Bay with giant sharks and turn that into a money spinner. I mean, then conservation and people win.
And of course, if you really don't want to swim in the ocean, buy a swimming pool. Solves the problem. And at the end of the day, we grew up in tidal swimming pools, and there was nothing wrong with those either. And of course, that was Justin Orion, and Justin is from UCT and a researcher. I always enjoy the information that comes out of the organization.